All right, welcome back everyone to the deep dive. You know, when we talk about the law, we often talk about the sort of like balancing act, right? Especially when you're dealing with tough situations. And today, well, we're diving into a case, Whitley v. Albers, that really throws you right into the middle of one of those balancing acts.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. How do you keep order, especially somewhere like a prison, where things can get really intense, but at the same time, make sure you're not tossing out the constitutional rights of the people inside, even if they are incarcerated?
Yeah, it's exactly what Whitley v. Albers is all about. And we've got some great source material that'll help us break down this landmark Supreme Court decision. We're going to see how the court grappled with this whole idea of when this use of force, especially by, authority figures, goes too far. Like, when does it cross the line and become what the Constitution calls cruel and unusual punishment?
And that's the mission for our deep dive today, right? To understand where the court landed on that question. Because like you said, the sources we have here, they really lay out the whole story, starting with the facts on the ground during a crazy prison riot, going through all the legal arguments, all the way to the Supreme Court's decision. So we'll unpack all that piece by piece to give you a clear idea of how this case, well, it basically set a precedent that's still shaping how we think about these issues today.
Okay, so to really get into this, we've got to set the scene first, right? Put ourselves right there at the Oregon State Penitentiary. I mean, picture it, a prison, not exactly a peaceful spa retreat on a normal day. But on this day, it's a total powder keg. We're talking full-blown riot. A guard, someone just doing their job, taken hostage. Their life is absolutely on the line. I mean, what even sparked this whole thing? How did it get to that point?
Believe it or not, it started with something, well, pretty ordinary, actually. A few inmates who happened to be intoxicated were resisting being moved. Standard prison procedure stuff. But then things escalated, and quickly. And that's when it turned tragic. A guard was grabbed, and the threat to him, it became very real, very fast. At this point, the responsibility fell on Harold Whitley. He was the prison security manager, and he had to try to manage this incredibly complex and very dangerous situation.
So what did he do? I mean, a riot, a hostage situation, that's got to be one of the toughest calls you can get in that job. What was his initial response?
His first move was crucial. He tried to negotiate. Imagine that, trying to talk down inmates in the middle of a riot with a hostage's life hanging in the balance, just to try to de-escalate things without resorting to even more force.
Okay, but negotiations, they don't always work, right? So what happened when those talks broke down? Did Whitley just like send in everyone?
Well, he did make the call for armed intervention, which, yeah, is a massive step up in terms of force. But he was careful about how this was organized. He put together an armed assault team, and the plan had two parts. First, they'd send in unarmed personnel just to see if they could get through to the inmates and maybe talk them down. But then, if that failed, the armed team would be the backup, ready to move in. And here's a detail that's super important. Whitley specifically instructed them to shoot low at any inmate who came near the area where they were holding the hostage. And remember that instruction, because it ends up being a big part of the legal arguments later on about what Whitley's intent really was.
Right, because it wasn't just a free-for-all. There was a specific tactic in play. And this is where we meet Gerald Albers. He was an inmate at the prison, but the circumstances of how he ended up shot, well, that's really what this whole case revolves around. So, what happened to Albers in the middle of all this chaos?
The key thing here is that Albers wasn't one of the inmates who started the riot or who was holding the guard hostage. He was, caught up in it, but not one of the instigators. And during that armed intervention, a correctional officer shot him in the knee. Now, Albers' story is that he was walking towards a staircase that was near where the hostage was, and he claims he had a reason. He says he was going to try and help protect some elderly inmates he knew who were in danger because of the riot. And that claim that he's trying to be a good Samaritan to help out other vulnerable prisoners, it becomes this really big point of contention as the case moves through the courts.
So we've got an inmate who wasn't involved in the original problem that gets shot during the response to the riot. That's automatically going to raise questions about whether the force used was justified, right? And how did this whole thing end up in the legal system?
Well, because of what happened, Albers filed a lawsuit. And he filed it under a really important piece of federal law, 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Now, this law, it basically creates a way for individuals to sue state or local officials if they think their constitutional rights have been violated. It's a major tool for holding the government accountable for rights abuses. And in his lawsuit, Albers said that getting shot in the knee, given all these circumstances, violated two of his constitutional rights. Specifically, he cited the Eighth Amendment, which, you know, prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and the 14th Amendment, which guarantees due process of law. And the case started, like many do, in the district court.
Okay, so district court, first stop in the legal journey. What happened there? What was their decision?
The district court actually made a pretty decisive move. They issued what's called a directed verdict in favor of Whitley. Basically, what that means is the judge said that, looking at all the evidence, no reasonable jury could conclude that Whitley and the other officials had done something that amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. So, case closed, right? Well, not exactly.
There's always another chapter in the legal saga, isn't there? So, what happened next? Did it get appealed?
Yep, you got it. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reviewed the case, and they ended up reversing that district court decision.
Whoa. Okay, so they disagreed pretty strongly. What was it about the case that made them see things differently?
The Ninth Circuit's opinion was that there was a real disagreement, you know, a genuine dispute about the facts, about whether the force used in this situation was too much. They felt that a jury should get to weigh all the evidence, hear all sides, and decide for themselves whether Albert's constitutional rights had really been violated. And this difference of opinion, this split between the district court saying no violation and the Ninth Circuit saying let the jury decide, that's exactly why the Supreme Court decided to grant what's called certiorari. It's when the highest court in the land says, okay, we're going to take this case on, because there's an important legal question that needs a clear answer.
Makes sense. So now we've got this big constitutional showdown heading all the way up to the Supreme Court. Albers is saying that both the 8th and 14th Amendments were violated. So let's break those arguments down a bit. What exactly was he claiming under each of those amendments?
All right, so with the 8th Amendment, Albers' argument was that being shot in the knee, no less, during this chaotic prison riot amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. And it's key to remember that the 8th Amendment is mostly focused on how convicted prisoners are treated. Now, his 14th Amendment claim, that was based on the Due Process Clause. He was saying that the state officials, by using excessive force, took away his liberty without going through a proper legal process. And sometimes the 14th Amendment, it can provide broader protection against, you know, bad behavior by the government than a more specific amendment like the 8th.
So, to sum it up, the Supreme Court had this huge question in front of them. Did the force used against Albers meet the definition of cruel and unusual punishment under the 8th Amendment? And did the 14th Amendment give him any extra ground to stand on, you know, any additional protection in this situation?
Got it. And it went down to the wire. In a 6-3 decision, with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor writing the opinion for the majority, the Supreme Court decided to side with Whitley and the prison officials. And that majority opinion, it did something big. It created a legal standard, a kind of test for how courts should evaluate the use of force in prisons, especially during emergencies like this riot. And that standard, it's still super important today.
Okay, so let's dig into the majority's position here. Justice O'Connor, she brought in this thing called the good faith effort standard. Can you explain what that actually means, practically speaking? And what was the court's logic behind setting up the specific standard?
Sure. Basically, the good faith effort standard says that if prison officials use force during a disturbance, it doesn't automatically violate the Eighth Amendment. The key is whether it was a good faith effort to bring things back under control, to restore order. It's about their intention, not just the outcome. The court was very focused on the incredible pressure, the chaos, the danger of a prison riot. They said, you got to imagine, these officials have to make split-second decisions to protect lives, both staff and inmates, and to regain control of a really volatile situation. And because of that, they argue that lower courts, they need to give a lot of deference, you know, sort of judicial respect to the decisions these officials make in those high-stress moments.
Deference. So does that mean that it's harder for an inmate who feels they were subjected to excessive force to win their case? Is the bar set pretty high because of this deference?
It does, in a way. And the court's reasoning for that really comes down to the practical side of running a prison. They acknowledge that there are just inherent dangers and challenges that prison officials face every single day. Mm-hmm. And during a riot, those dangers skyrocket. They basically said that if courts second guess every single decision made in the heat of the moment, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it would tie the hands of those officials and could actually put everyone in the prison in more danger.
So the focus shifts then. It's not about whether the use of force looks reasonable when you're calmly looking back at it later. It's about what the officials were thinking, what their mindset was at the moment they made the decision.
Exactly. The court made it very clear. The most important thing to look at is the state of mind of the prison officials. Were they sincerely trying to fix a dangerous situation, restore order, and protect people? Or were they acting out of malice, wanting to inflict pain for no good reason? That difference, that's crucial. Even if an inmate gets hurt, that injury on its own isn't enough to say the Eighth Amendment was violated. Under this standard, you'd have to show that the main reason behind the force was malicious, not a good faith attempt to end the riot.
Okay, makes sense. Now, what about Alber's 14th Amendment argument? Did the Supreme Court even consider that separately?
Well, the majority opinion straight up rejected the idea that the 14th Amendment gave Alber's some other path to relief in this specific type of situation. Justice O'Connor basically wrote that when you're dealing with the use of force in a prison to maintain security, the main and controlling constitutional rule is the Eighth Amendment, because it directly addresses how convicted prisoners should be treated. So in cases like this, the court basically merged the two claims, saying you analyze everything through the lens of the Eighth Amendment.
All right, so that's the majority opinion, but we've got to talk about the dissent, too. Justice Marshall clearly wasn't on board with all of this. What were his main disagreements with the majority?
Right, Justice Marshall. He had some serious concerns. The core of his dissent was that this malicious intent standard, it just set the bar way too high. He didn't think it was right to make an inmate prove that prison officials acted out of pure malice to win their case. He thought it was too hard to prove. Instead, he had another standard he thought would be more fair. Whether the force that was used amounted to an unnecessary and wanton infliction of pain. He argued that this standard would do a better job of protecting prisoners from excessive force, even if you couldn't prove, like, pure evil intent. He wanted the focus to be more on the nature of the force itself, the impact it had, not just what was going on in the official's head.
So a big difference there. The majority is all about intent, what the official was thinking. The dissent's more focused on the actual effect of the force, regardless of intent. What else did Justice Marshall point out in his dissent? What other parts of the case bothered him?
He also zeroed in on some key factual disputes. He thought these disputes should have been presented to a jury to figure out. For example, there was some back and forth about whether the riot was still really raging at the exact moment when Albers got shot. Some evidence suggested that the worst of it was over, that things were calming down. And if that's true, Marshall argued, then needing to use that kind of force, it just wouldn't make sense. It would make it much more likely that the force used against Albers was unnecessary and excessive.
Yeah, I can see how that timing would be important. And what about Albers' story, his claim that he was trying to help those older inmates? Did Justice Marshall address that at all?
Oh, absolutely. He specifically brought up Albers' claim that he was headed towards where they were holding the hostage to help those elderly inmates. He said that's another factual dispute that a jury should have gotten to consider. Because think about it, if Albers really was trying to help others and he wasn't a threat himself, then shooting him, well, that seems even more unjustified, right? It looks a lot worse. And on top of that, Marshall also brought up the fact that Albers allegedly didn't get proper medical care right after he was shot. He said that could be another sign that they were just disregarding his well-being, you know, not taking his situation seriously.
So it sounds like the dissent really wanted to paint a different picture of what happened, and they were pushing for a much lower legal threshold, making it easier to say that the Eighth Amendment was violated in these kinds of cases.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Marshall's dissent was a reminder that we need to look closely at the specific facts of each case, you know, not just take the word of prison officials, especially when there are real questions about whether the force they used was truly necessary.
Okay, so clearly, this case has had a big impact. This whole Whitley test that we talked about, it's still important today. So can you walk us through it? What are those four factors that courts use now because of this decision when they're looking at Eighth Amendment claims that come out of prison disturbances?
Absolutely. That Whitley decision, it basically laid out a framework that courts still use today to analyze these Eighth Amendment claims. They use these four factors to help them figure out if the use of force was a good faith effort to regain control, or if it was malicious and sadistic, like the court was worried about. And the first factor they look at is the need for the application of force. So they basically ask, what was the threat level? Was any force even necessary in this particular situation?
All right, so step one is figuring out if using force was justified at all. What's the second factor?
The second factor gets into the relationship between the need for force and how much force was actually used. This is about proportionality. They ask, was the level of force a reasonable response to the threat that they saw? Were there other options, maybe less forceful options, that they could have tried but didn't?
So it's not just about whether any force was needed. It's about whether they used the right kind and amount of force, given what was happening. Got it. What's the third part of this Whitley test?
Okay, so the third factor is the extent of the injury that the inmate suffered. Now, even though the Supreme Court, the majority at least, emphasized the intent of the officials, the severity of the injury, it can still be important evidence. If someone ends up seriously hurt, it could suggest that maybe the force was too much, or that it was more likely to have been done with, you know, malicious intent.
Yeah, I can see how that would be hard to ignore, even if intent is the focus. So what's the last factor that courts consider?
The fourth and final factor is whether the officials tried to, you know, reduce the severity of their response to minimize the harm they were causing. So they look at things like, did they give warnings before using force? Were there less lethal options available that they could use? And maybe most importantly, did the inmate get quick medical attention after the force was used? These four factors, taken together, they give courts a structured way to evaluate these situations, which can be really messy and complicated.
It makes sense to have a clear system, especially in these tough cases. And it's obvious that this case is still a major precedent in any situation where force is used in a prison setting. So what makes Whitley v. Albers so important even all these years later? What's the key takeaway for someone who's really interested in this area of law?
I think the biggest impact of Whitley v. Albers, the thing that really stuck, is that idea of judicial deference to prison officials.
Yeah.
It basically says that when those officials are making decisions in emergency situations, courts need to give them a lot of leeway. And the case also solidified that idea that to prove an Eighth Amendment violation in these cases, you have to show the officials acted with obduracy and wantonness, basically, a really bad state of mind.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just show they made a mistake or even that they used more force than was absolutely necessary.
So it all comes back to intent. Proving that the officials acted with that really bad, wanton state of mind, that they didn't care about the well-being of the inmate, it's not enough to just say that the outcome was bad or that things could have been handled differently.
Exactly. And that focus on the official's intent, it has some big implications for holding people accountable in prisons. It makes it harder for inmates to win these cases, to prove that their constitutional rights were violated. And while it's super important to keep order and make sure everyone in a prison, staff and inmates, are safe, well, that dissent from Justice Marshall, it reminds us that this deference that we give to prison officials, it shouldn't mean that we just ignore potential abuses of power. It reminds us that officials should be held responsible when they use force that's clearly unnecessary, when it's too much, and when it causes real harm. This case, it really puts a spotlight on that ongoing debate, that really hard question. Where do you draw the line? When is force legitimate in a tough environment, and when does it cross over into cruel and unusual punishment?
It's a question that doesn't have an easy answer, that's for sure. So looking back on Whitley v. Albers, it's clear that the Supreme Court was trying to find a way to balance these competing priorities, right? Keeping order during a prison riot while still protecting the rights of the inmates is a tough job.
And the good faith effort standard, along with those four factors the court set out, well, they give us a framework to evaluate these situations. But Justice Marshall's dissent, it's a powerful reminder that we can't just take that deference to prison officials too far. We always have to look at the facts, the specific circumstances of every single incident.
Absolutely. This deep dive into Whitley v. Albers, it shows us that even in these moments of crisis, in the toughest environments, the Constitution, it still matters. It makes us think about not just what people do, but why they do it. And that leads to a bigger question, one that goes way beyond prison walls. When we're talking about the use of force in any context, how much weight should we put on intent versus outcome? That emphasis on wantonness in this case, what does that say about how our legal system looks at responsibility, especially when lives are at stake? I think that's something worth thinking about.
I agree. It's definitely something to consider.